Jeffrey, what's that in your coffee cup?
What do you think it is, Jen? It's Death Wish Coffee. It's the only coffee I drink. Death Wish is the world's strongest coffee, and the world's strongest salesperson needs the world's strongest coffee.
Jeffrey and I drink it, and diehards, you need to be drinking it too. It'll help you wake up and smell the order forms. They have 100% no bullshit money back guarantee, so go get your first bag or first box of K-Cups of the world's strongest coffee at deathwishcoffee.com.
So what does an order form smell like?
I want to make that leap. How do you best make that leap, and how do you prove yourself at the new place?
So I think I tell people, you know, I tell people this all the time. The two things that I think helped me propel my career were, you know, I come from, my mom left when I was two. It was just me and my dad for a lot of years until he got remarried. And so he had, you know, he's from the Bronx, tremendous work ethic. So effort, number one. And then number two is, I think people miss, is self-education.
Where do we start this? An answer doesn't matter. We're having a good time. Right.
He couldn't wait to get in here.
You need sales balls to make sales calls. I'm tweeting that puppy. Okay. This is Sell or Die, the only sales podcast on the planet that isn't afraid to say you're either selling or you're dying. Because there's no second place in sales. Win or go hungry. I'm Jeffrey Gittimer, author of The Little Red Book of Selling.
And I'm Jen Gluckow, founder of Sales in a New York Minute. And today, we are going to help you sell like hell.
Oh, yeah.
We've got a great guest coming up. But first, we want to introduce you to the one, the only, our man behind the curtain, behind the glass wall.
Wait, it's a glass window.
What? You know, it's a metaphor here. It's okay. Our amazing producer, Mr. Doug Branson. Hey, Doug.
Hello, Jeffrey. Hello, Jennifer. I want to remind everyone they can subscribe to this podcast and share it with their friends on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Overcast, wherever you get your podcast. Just search Sell or Die and make sure to leave us a review. We always love getting feedback from the diehards out there.
Five stars or nothing.
That's
Doug
right.
Doug sounds amazing on the mic.
We're the Uber of podcasts. We want a five-star rating.
Except we don't rate you. You only rate us. And don't forget to join us for Motivation Mondays, our live sales meeting on Facebook.com/Jeffrey Gittimer. We put on the podcast feed as well. But if you join us live on Facebook, you get to see us, interact with us, engage with us, ask us questions, or just say hello.
Okie dokie. Let's get to the rest of the show. It's time to sell or die.
Diehards, Chris Ressa is the Executive Vice President and COO of DLC Management, one of the nation's preeminent owners, operators, and managers of shopping centers. We all know I like that.
Yep.
Before DLC, he worked for the Sherwin-Williams Company as a real estate manager, handling existing store renewals and new stores in the Eastern Division region. Now, he oversees over 20 million square feet of commercial real estate. Holy moly. Diehards, please help me welcome Chris.
Hey, Chris, one quick question. My dad manufactured kitchen cabinets, and we bought Sherwin-Williams paint in Berlin, New Jersey, at the factory where they made it at the time. They're right next to a water thing, which I'm sure they polluted the piss out of. But the bottom line is we bought paint and solvent from Sherwin-Williams. And we bought it in 55-gallon drums. Guess how much the paint was per gallon?
I don't know. How much?
$1.15.
Oh, my God.
And my dad went nuts when they raised it to $1.20.
Yeah. There's good. Sherwin's got paint that you could buy for $80 a gallon today. It's really insane.
That is crazy.
But we used spray paint. I was actually one of the few Jews that could actually use a spray painter.
I love it.
But they had masks and, you know, we had a paint booth and a big suction thing and all. You know, it was pretty cool.
Well, while we're on the subject, what was one of the biggest lessons or the biggest lesson that you learned from working at Sherwin-Williams?
So that was my first job out of college. And, you know, I was the buyer at that time. So I was going out and opening new stores And so the people who were the owners of shopping centers or just property were trying to sell me the property for Sherwin Williams to open a location. So I think the biggest thing for me is I got a taste on the buyer side of the business first and how the buyer really looks at the opportunity versus people who just get into sales and haven't had that experience in purchasing or buying or whatever they're doing. Mm-hmm. My first job out of college was the buyer.
So you have two categories of buyers, sellers, right? Douchebags and not douchebags.
Oh, yeah, man.
Okay, correct. But in those days, and I don't want to say in those days, but when you first started, there was very little database stuff and very little online stuff that you could really refer to make a decision. Some of it was gut, correct?
Yeah, so there was definitely gut, but, you know, they were a Fortune 200 company. And so they still had a lot of, or Fortune 500, you know, they were large at the time. They had a lot of analytics, you know, they knew exactly where their customers were. They knew where they needed to be. They knew what their demographics were. They knew what their average unit, you know, their average sales could be based on these demographics. So they had that side of it. Was the side that really today still that, you know, machines and robots that, you know, aren't there yet is that intangible, like, you know, they could tell you to be, the machine today could tell you that you need to be in Alpine, New Jersey, but they don't know the nuances and the differences between, you know, this corner versus that corner, which are 300 feet away, but there's a big difference between the two. And so that still is, you know, was critical then, still is today, and I think will be in the future for the buyer. Yeah, the analytics have improved, but I can tell you even back then, companies like that, they had serious data.
And what about proof that the real estate location was in fact good based on other tenants?
So that's, and I deal with that more in my world today where retail sales, you know, a lot of tenants are choosing locations. You know, they're letting someone else be the test dummy. And so if you're, you know, pick the tenant, I don't know, Sally Beauty and TJ Maxx does well, and you know your customers like that, it gives you a little more conviction that you'll do well and you'll do well in a TJ Maxx shopping center. With Sherwin-Williams, it's not very impulsive of a buy, right? Paint is something that you're deciding about, right?
It's destination.
And so it's a destination. And so with paint, they were less concerned necessarily about they were concerned about the retail sales in the trade area. But one of the things we were concerned about, right, is at the time for Sherwin-Williams, 75% of the business was contractor-based, and the high-margin business was what they called the DIY customer. If me or you guys went and tried to paint our own bedroom. And so they were trying to dip more into that, but we were looking like when there was a Dunkin' Donuts or a Subway where the contractor would come in the morning to get coffee and then go pick up his paint to go paint the house. We liked those types of locations, right? And things like that. We wanted them easily accessible, you know, front and center, the out parcel so that, you know, the guy could be driving to the job, pull off, grab the paint, get right off and go. So they were, you know, that was the types of things we were looking at. We didn't want to be, while we weren't impulse driven, we didn't want to be off the beaten path,
right,
and make it inconvenient for the GC and stuff like that.
Have you ever seen that thing on YouTube about how to buy paint if you're buying an airline ticket?
No, I haven't. No.
Check it out.
I've never seen this either.
A guy goes into the paint store and says, I need a gallon of paint. And the clerk says, what day are you going to paint on? And that... Because if you're going to paint on a Saturday, it's cheaper than if you paint on a Thursday.
Oh, my God.
And it is hysterical, and you need to have it. You totally need to have it. Airline paint will probably get it for you.
All right. So let's go back to you. How did you get from Sherwin-Williams over to commercial real estate?
So, you know, I had big, large corporation. I was in the real estate department. There was an attorney there. And I had my annual review and I got like a 3% raise. And I was like, man, what do you got to do to like get up and grow here? You know, and I'm doing the math and I'm like, well, yeah, I could be stable here at Sherwin's, great company. And by the time I'm 55, I'll make a good living. But, you know, I want to make more money than 3% raise, right? When you're, you know, at an entry-level job, it's a challenge. And so the attorney that I was with gave me some sage advice. He was like, listen, I went to Notre Dame. I have a great law degree. I don't make a lot of money, Chris. I'm a lawyer. He's like, if I wanted to make a lot of money, I would move to D.C. or New York. I'd work for a law firm, and I would work 18-hour days. He's like, you know, at the end of the day, you're a function of Sherwin-Williams business. You're not their business. The people who make the most money here sell the most paint. And so if you want to be in real estate, you need to go work for a real estate company. If you want to be in marketing, don't be the marketing department for Verizon. Go work for the best marketing company out there. If you want to be in finance, don't work in the finance department at Dell. Go work for the best financial company. He's like, you know, if you really want to be in real estate, you better go work for a real estate company because that's where your income's going to grow. And so 2 weeks later, I went and worked at a real estate company.
Way to go. Way to go.
I love it. I love it.
I need to ask a big picture question. How has Amazon.com affected the way you rent a property, and have rents gone down in order to keep them filled?
So in general, I think Amazon has lit a fire under retail owners, right? We're definitely in the midst of disruption. I think the headline news is it's of e-commerce is really the tailwind. The reality is, I think Amazon buying Whole Foods, brick and mortar chain, opening stores. The reality is that you need multiple channels to sell. That's period, end of story. You can't just do one. If you look at pure play e-commerce tenants that are in growth mode today, not a lot of them are generating a profit. They can certainly gain market share, but it took Amazon a long time to really generate a profit and actually not just growing market share. Whereas a lot of the mature retailers that are publicly traded today are forced to make a profit because they're mature and they're not in growth mode. So they have that advantage where they can just go, you know, find market share and not an unprofitable market share and then figure it out later. And a lot of e-commerce chains are still doing that. In order to make money, they're all opening. You know, I was just at a conference where there was over 1,000 digitally native brands that are opening up brick and mortar stores. UNTUCKit and Warby Parker and all these digitally native brands who are opening up brick and mortar stores. So, you know, is America overstored? Sure. It's, you know, there's certain pockets where there's too many stores. But I think the key is the following. There's really bucketed into two areas. You have the group that is the value-oriented segment. There's a lot of people out here who in the world who are still very focused on price. They either can't afford more or they don't want to spend more. And then you have the Amazon, which is really focused on convenience. And there's a premium to buy convenience. There's a significant amount of the population that doesn't want to pay for it. And there's a significant amount that can't pay for convenience. And so we play in the value game and the open air world. We're not in the enclosed world. And I think the guys who are challenged and what you're seeing today is the people in the middle who don't have a value proposition, aren't providing convenience. And I'm putting luxury in, you know, Louis Vuitton. They're so niche in a different category. In traditional retail, you either provide a value proposition or you provide convenience. I think the guys in the middle are the ones who are hurting. And that's why you've seen a lot with the Macy's and the JCPenney's of the world, because are they really giving, if you can go to TJ Maxx and get the $90 polo for $30, they're losing on the value proposition. And it's, you know, it's not that convenient when I can go to Amazon and get it for in an hour.
Yeah, I'm going to throw this at you. I don't think Amazon bought Whole Foods as an investment as much as they did to buy it as a learning tool. They're learning.
Totally agree. Yeah. I agree.
Okay, so what are you going to do when they put the Amazon bookstores in 250 of your centers? And what are you going to do when they put...
He'll be happy because they'll be paying him rent.
Yeah, but Barnes & Noble is going to go south for the winter. And Amazon bookstores are about a third of the size.
So there's definitely, in general, there's a, you know, at the moment, right, Of all retail sales, 13% are e-commerce today. So 87% are still brick and mortar. That's clearly going in the direction of e-commerce. I think that the reality is, though, that people miss is that 50% of all e-commerce is Amazon. And so everybody else is fighting for the other 50%. So it's really not the internet versus brick and mortar or clicks and bricks. It's Amazon versus everybody else. Mm-hmm. That's really the discussion that we're not having. It's really Amazon versus everyone who's an e-commerce business, who's a brick and mortar business, who's a web services business. It's really Amazon. This, you just have this ginormous, unbelievable company who's growing. And so, I'm not going to pretend I can see the future and I know how it all shakes out. I can tell you, as a landlord, I'll take Amazon credit all day.
Right.
Yeah. 100%. However, when a company like UNTUCKit or Warby Parker comes into a retail center, now they have to learn, number one, that there's increased costs. That the reason they went online to begin with is because you didn't have the overhead of a retail store. And they're going to have to adjust everything from pricing to profit margins in order to be able to compete in the brick and mortar world.
I would tell you that's a misnomer, that it's more costly to operate a brick and mortar store than it is to sell on e-commerce. I think it is for the guy, if Jeff and Chris want to open up and sell Jeff and Chris t-shirts and we want to just sell some t-shirts. When you're opening up these large businesses like UNTUCKit has said every single location is profitable today. Whereas if you look at all these, go look at Wayfair. Wayfair lost $500 million in 2018. Mm-hmm. That is a lot of money. I don't know how sustainable it is to lose $500 million. Bed Bath
probably
and Beyond,
for about 6 months.
I know, right? So Bed Bath and Beyond has been really hammered by Wall Street, right? Sales are declining. They're still a profitable company. They make money. And so I think right now, I think the missing thing is it's very easy for all these young guys to generate an app and to go raise money. It is. And, you know, all these smart guys, I think, you know, one of the things in your show, it takes a special group in the sales world to actually make money. I think raising money right now,
I agree.
There's money everywhere. You can raise money. Making money's hard, though.
Yep. And keeping it is even harder.
Yeah.
Okay.
For sure.
So I want to go back to your story of origin. Oh. You were at Sherwin-Williams.
Yeah.
You leave to go to this real estate firm and you were growing at Sherwin-Williams. They gave you a raise. Well, growing in a sense as much as you could, right?
Yeah.
And you go someplace else and now you're a newbie. What was that transition like, and what would you recommend to our diehards who really resonated with that, like, wow, okay, what Chris said there was so powerful. I want to make that leap. How do you best make that leap, and how do you prove yourself at the new place?
So I think I tell people, I tell people this all the time. The two things that I think helped me propel my career were, I come from, my mom left when I was two. It was just me and my dad for a lot of years till he got remarried. And so he had, he's from the Bronx, tremendous work ethic. So effort, number one. And then number two is, I think people miss, is self-education. And I spent an inordinate amount of time trying to educate myself so that I could, I realized really quick I wasn't the smartest guy in the room. And I said, I better get my act together or I'm not going to be able to swim in these waters. And so I think those two things, just effort and self-education, are, paramount. I was sitting there, I did the following. When I walked, every morning before 7 a.m., I was in the office cutting out Wall Street Journal articles if it had to do with commercial real estate or retail. And I put them in a binder and I was reading them and trying to educate myself. Clearly, you don't have to do that today. But I think the key was, so at 23 years old, I could walk into, at the Panera Bread or Starbucks, and I knew everything about their business. I knew what was going on. I was 23, but I had my stuff together with that versus, and so that's what I think the one of the keys that people miss, right? And I think it's active learning. A lot of people, people are like, oh, you got to read. One of the things I was very focused on was active learning versus passive learning. So I read a Wall Street Journal article and it used a word CMBS. I had no idea what that was. And so now I'm going to Google and I'm trying to understand what is CMBS. It's commercial backed securities, right? And so what, you know, with social media today, everyone could just peruse Twitter. And I talk about this with my sales team all the time. And they're, as they're learning, they're perusing Twitter. And I'm like, that doesn't cut it for me. That is not good enough. You better be actively learning.
Hello, everybody. This is Jake Stenziano, host of the Wheelbarrow Profits Podcast, here with my co-host, the multifamily mentor, Mr. Gino Barbaro.
The Wheelbarrow Profits Podcast catalogs our journey to becoming financially free through multifamily real estate investing.
Gang, each week we interview a guest specifically chosen for their expertise in and around multifamily real estate.
We talk you through our entire process, every victory and every misstep and everything that we've learned along the way.
What does that look like? Buy right, manage right, and finance right.
The audio podcast is available wherever fine podcasts are found.
Or check us out on our YouTube page where you'll find tons of other great content.
So, okay, and then how did you grow your real estate business? Because you're in this new industry that's new to you, right? And you've obviously worked your way up. We know the end of the story, but I want to figure out how you got there. So how did you gain clients? Was it more focused on cold calling or networking or social media? Like, what was the form that you took to build relationships?
So in commercial real estate, there's some groups who are not traditional operators, and they third party the work, which is they just are an investment vehicle and they third party everything. So the group I worked for was an operator. So everything was in-house. We weren't third partying anything. And the group I work for today is that. So we had property that we owned, and I was given the yellow pages and said, this is the property we own. We need tenants in these spaces. Go fill them. And so self-education was really important for me. So it was, in the beginning, it was twofold. There was a lot of knocking on doors and it was a lot of cold calling. We also, there's big trade show organization, ICSC, International Council of Shopping Centers, where they connect people. So finding out who the right guy is not hard at all. It was before LinkedIn, I could go on the ICSC's website and find out who was the Starbucks guy for New York or who was the McDonald's guy for California. That's easy to do in our industry. So that's not an excuse, because it's very easy to find who those people are. The other thing on the local tenants, we still do today, a lot of knocking on doors. I'm going to the shopping center across the street and talking to the nail salon. When is his lease up? What is he, what's going on with his rent? How's his landlord? And how can we move him into our center? So I was doing a lot of physical door-to-door canvassing and a lot of cold calling. What I came to find on the physical door-to-door canvassing was that, a lot of people really struggle with that. I really liked it, connecting with all these local business owners. Typically, when you walk into the nail salon or the barbershop, or the restaurant, the owner is not the guy you're talking to. One of the things we teach is you treat everyone as if they are the owner, and that's where you get the real information. Instead of walking in, never walk in and say, is the owner available? Don't do that. I'd rather walk in and say, we want you. And the person's very confused. And they're like, what do you mean? I love this restaurant. We need you to open up in the next town over in our shopping center. And then you build a rapport and you start a relationship with that person. And by the end of that conversation, I know who the owner is and I have a meeting with that owner. So that, I think for the door-to-door canvassing, I learned really quick, was really helpful for us to get meetings and appointments. It's a lot easier than a lot of other industries when you're walking into office buildings and there's security guards and you got to go meet with the office manager and all. That's a lot harder. I'm dealing with a disruption in the industry, much like Uber and taxi cabs online, but getting to the person who I need to get to, to me is a lot simpler than my industry would like to believe. Finding the owner of the restaurant, the pizza guy, you can get to him a lot easier than you can the office building in Manhattan, trying to find the office manager to sell him a copier. It's much harder.
Yeah, for sure.
I usually use the freight elevator.
Yeah, they love him.
Those guys were always $5 and let me on the elevator.
Yeah.
So how do you train your team now? Are there strategies you use that help them with cold calling and cold canvassing? We have a lot of diehards who do cold calls and do show up to businesses. And what are some of the strategies you help your team with?
So first thing, I was a sales guy that moved through the organization and was very successful sales, ended up into sales management, ended up into a place where I was managing people who managed people. And that led me to the COO role, where now I oversee our construction department, marketing, leasing, property management. It's about 70 people. We're about a 120 person company. One of the things I did, and I, our CEO was, and we're entrepreneurial, we're large, we compete with some of the, the largest public companies, we're bigger than some, but we're still private. One of the things that we did is we brought on a guy, his title is Vice President of Training and Development. And he, if you're a rookie at a college, we put you on his team right away. I used to, and I kind of loved it. Even when I was high up, if you were a rookie out of college, you came and worked directly for me. I ran out of time as I'm growing the business and we have, billions of dollars worth of real estate. I just, it's not a great use of my time, even though they're critical and I have a passion for managing the sales folks. So we hired that person. So the rookies go on that team. And then, so there's that component that was really critical for me and important for me to put in place in our organization. And so he's on college campuses recruiting and whatnot. From a cold calling perspective, I think we're doing a couple of things. So we have frameworks, we follow just like everyone else. We follow you guys and Jeb Blunt and Mike Weinberg and everyone going to Outbound and all that. So we've got a lot of self-education.
Are we
going to
meet you at Outbound?
Yeah, are you coming Outbound?
Yeah.
Woo!
I am, yeah.
That's awesome.
So
When they introduce me, I want you to stand up and scream, go Jersey.
Will do. Okay. Will do, for sure.
Oh, man.
So easy framework, a little more tactical, for a cold call, we teach, and a guy, John Klimshin, taught me this, and he wrote the book, How to Sell Without Being a Jerk. And this was a good framework that we used, which is who you are, where you're from, why you're calling, and a killer open-ended question. So that's a tactical framework we teach rookies to get comfortable on the phone, those four pieces. But we're constantly training and coming up with days on things on all cold outreach, whether that's social media, whether that is cold email, we have Sales Navigator, whether that is knocking on doors and canvassing. But that's a tactical framework we use, for the rookies on a cold call. And on a follow-up call, I guess a more tactical framework we would use on a follow-up would be review the past, discuss the present, plan the future together. And that's mm-hmm. our framework for a follow-up. And, those are some of the roots I got from John Klimshin a long time ago. You can look him up. That looks like, last time we spoke, right? Mm-hmm. That's the framework on reviewing the past, discussing their present is you were telling me about this that was going on in your business. You have a dialogue and then you focus on planning the future, which is usually a meeting or maybe another call, depending. And so that's our framework for a follow-up, our framework for an initial cold call is, hi, this is Chris Ressa. I work for the owner of Beach Shopping Center in Peekskill, New York. We're in desperate need of a pizza place to come to our shopping center. Who might be the best person to speak to about that opportunity? Versus asking for the owner, I always flip, we talk in open-ended questions often to get people in dialogue versus, getting to a yes or no typically leads to a no. And so, asking an open question, sure. Like who might be the best person to speak to about this they don't say no. They say, well, that's the owner, John. And right. now that leads into another conversation.
Yeah.
Can you, do you ask a question like, I'm a world-class expert in revenue per square foot, and I was wondering if I could talk to the person whose job it is to increase revenue per square foot.
Yeah, I would, we do things like that for sure in frameworks, especially, you know, I gave you our rookie framework as we work up the sales ladder and we're changing dialogue a little bit as they get more comfortable. When they're a rookie, I want them to feel that they can talk to anybody. We have like, you know, our bullpen out there and, you know, a lot of our younger sales folks, I'll notice they'll go into a conference room and, you know, start dialing and I will pull them right out of the conference room back here so they gain confidence and they feel good talking, right? I'm constantly, whether it's a sales call or not, I'm on calls all day in my role. I'm walking around the office and, you know, continuing still to build my confidence on the phone. And so that framework really allows people to feel, to gain the confidence to get through that call in the beginning and to have a structure that leads to a productive call. But yeah, as far as I call that being remarkable, Jeff, and you know, we want our sales folks to be, and we call them leasing people because they're leasing space, but it's sales. We want our leasing folks to be remarkable, and that is definitely a way that you can become remarkable. I would just flip the end is to, if I was asking for the person, who might be the person I speak to about increasing your revenue to a world-class level versus can you point me in the direction of the world-class level?
Yeah, because they could easily say no, whereas now it's like, okay, let me think about that and get you the right
exactly.
person.
One day I was walking on an airplane.
Because on the first cold call, I don't mind no, because I don't mind no later on, but on the... when I have that gatekeeper who answers the phone, if I get no, I'm in trouble. I need to get past her. And
right.
so I can't let her tell me no, right? Getting the decision maker who tells me no, that's okay because I'll get through that. But I can't have the gatekeeper tell me no.
I'm getting on an airplane one day and there was a guy with a Burger King button on. And I said, what do you do? He says, I'm in charge of opening up retail Burger Kings. I said, wow, that must require a lot of work. And he goes, no, we just opened up across the street from McDonald's.
Yeah.
So they've already done all the research. They've already done all the crap. And this guy goes in and buys Uncle Land and puts up a building.
I love it.
Totally.
So here's the question our diehards are dying to know.
Yeah.
You're a COO, you're C-suite. How do salespeople get through to your gatekeeper in order to talk to someone like you?
So I get whether it's through digital media or it's through the phone call, I'm getting people are reaching out cold to me every day. And so I think what one of the things that when they get my direct dial, or if you look on LinkedIn, I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. You can reach out to me. Getting through my gatekeeper is definitely a challenge, but it's not hard to get me directly. I'm pretty open about it. You can get me directly. I think to keep me on the phone, you have to connect with me.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And so that you have to connect with me, right? I recently had there's a guy who works for a technology company and he's trying to sell me, you know, it's a SaaS company. He's trying to sell me software. And, you know, he reached out to me and he's like, I saw you posting about your goals. We should talk about that. Here's how I can help you get to those goals. And so I thought it was clever. He referenced a LinkedIn article I posted a couple of weeks ago, and versus this guy who knows, you know, versus someone in the C-suite, what I've gotten more of than anything now, I have more financial advisors calling me than I ever knew even existed.
Of course.
My phone is ringing with financial advisors every day. I was shocked. I never had one ever call me. Now I have about 3,000. And they're sending me things about, you know, do I know something about this tax incentive? And they're all sending me the same
thing. I got
thing.
That
no.
yesterday. Did you know? And I'm
this
like,
this guy doesn't
what?
Get a return from me. He doesn't get a call from me. He this... knows nothing about me.
I like oh, the guy. Man. I like the guy who says he's calling me from a stock brokerage firm, and he says we think there's 20% in Sony, and I was calling to talk to you about it. And I said, well, dude, I buy books for $2 and sell them for 20. What do you got? So,
oh man,
the challenge is how do they engage you? Correct.
Correct.
And if they intrigue that you, if they intrigue you, you'll spend 15 minutes with them.
100%. If they can connect, engage me, and have some right. I'm a sales guy. I've done the relevant research before I reach out to Starbucks, right? If you don't take the time and do your homework to connect with me and understand what I'm doing and you're just blanket cold calling everyone, you're going to get some, right? Effort will win. There's definitely a place where if you have a list of 1,000 people and you call people, you're going to, because of effort, you will get some. You want to get that real big fish, that really big key client, that key sale. You have to have some homework and connect them, right? I have people out there who are making 1,000 calls in a week, and because of effort and just the randomness, they will get through to somebody and make a sale. Will it be the biggest fish in the pond? It will not be. It will not be me who they want to spend $1 million on the software.
Another fantastic episode of Sell or Die is now in the books.
Let's let the listener be the judge of that.
You can be. Subscribe. Rate and review our show today. In fact, right now.
Or if that sounds too complicated, tell a friend.
Tell both your friends.
Because if you're not selling,
you're dying.
We're leaving.
Au revoir.
Shalom. Die Hards. If you love the show, make sure you've subscribed.
And if you've subscribed, make sure you rate us on iTunes or give us a star on Overcast.
And if you've done all of that, tell a friend about the best sales podcast on the planet. Or better yet, tell both your friends.
And if you've done all of that, well, you're a true Sell or Die Hard, and we thank you.
This has been a presentation of the Sell or Die Network. For more podcasts that you can take out into the street and turn into money, visit sellordienetwork.com.